This meeting of the House Resources Committee will now come to order. It is now 1:02 p.m., Friday, January 23rd, 2025, in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Representative Fields, Representative Coulombe, Representative Hall, Representative Mears, Representative Elam, Representative Sadler, Co-Chair Representative Dibert, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Freer, as well as Representative Prox just joined us. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phone for the duration of the meeting. I'd like to thank Jordan Nicholson from Records and Zach Lawhorn from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. On today's agenda, we have an update from the Department of Natural Resources on oil and gas production and lease activity on the North Slope and Cook Inlet in 2025. Before the committee today, we have Commissioner Designee John Crowther and Division of Oil and Gas Director Derek Nottingham. Welcome to House Resources, and thank you for joining us. Please come to the table and begin your presentation.
Thank you very much, Chair Freer, and members of the committee. My name is John Crowther, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Natural Resources, for the record. It's an honor to be here, and we're very happy to share our presentation today. As I'm sure you're aware, the department historically has presented our production forecast, so the technical details of the material about upcoming production that we share with the Department of Revenue to inform the Revenue Sources Book. We typically do that for the Finance Committees this first week of session. We're very pleased and appreciate the committee's request to dig a little bit more into production and activity so that you all have that information, naturally the jurisdiction of the committee, about our use and development of our resources. So we're here to share that today. In very quick summary, and we'll get into the details, we have a what we would describe as a good news story to share. We have a lot of activity on the North Slope. We have front-end exploration activities, so very initial work going on in different areas of the North Slope. We have projects developing with characterization wells, and we have, for the first time in a long time, major new greenfield projects that are about to come online and materially add to our production. So on the North Slope, we have a great amount of activity, and we'll share that in detail. We're also here to talk a little bit about the Cook Inlet. Fortunately, we have a lot of activity in the Cook Inlet to report on, and that's very positive and important for our energy supply for South Central Alaska and the Rail Belt. But you know, we do have some challenges about long-term supply and the need to have plans for additional energy supplies in the inlet. So we can talk a little bit in detail about the activity we're seeing there, and then you know, I imagine that this committee and the legislature will be actively discussing some of those other longer-term energy approaches throughout this session. So with that said, it's an honor and a pleasure to be here, and I'll turn it over to our very capable director to begin the presentation.
Thank you, Commissioner Designee Crowther, and thank you, Chair Freer, and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon to walk you through what John said. It was a very good news story, and I'll just kind of preface with a little bit about the order of what we're going to see. I'll do a little bit of overview of production for the North Slope as a whole, and then I'll walk through the production forecast, a few slides on those, walk through some of the North Slope lease results from this past fall, lease sale results from this past fall, some of the projects that are ongoing, and then we'll talk about Cook Inlet supply and the activities going on there. So without further ado, I'll move along here. So just a quick overview of cumulative North Slope oil production. That bottom bullet down there in the bubble says 19,223 million barrels of oil produced. I'll probably refer to that as something like 19.2 billion barrels of oil. We're almost on 50 years of production from the North Slope. As you look at the map in front of you, you can kind of see the range in oil production from the various producing units. And obviously right there in the middle is Prudhoe Bay with 14.2 billion out of that 19.2 billion. So that is obviously the lion's share where the oil production is. Prudhoe Bay is a field like no other field. There's probably not another one like it in the world. It's probably a one in a million kind of find with the size of oil resource, the type of rock, the drive mechanism, those kind of things going on within it. It is a marvelous field. We are very fortunate to have been able to produce that and see those resources brought forward over the last 50 years. Kuparuk River, you can kind of see, is almost at 3 billion barrels, a world-class field in and of itself, very high recovery factor, lots of activity. Probably another one of those, you know, top-tier fields in the entire world. And as you kind of look out, as you expand away, both to the west and to the east of those major fields, there are some really large producers like the Colville River. And as you look further west in the MPA, starting to see some production out of Greater Moose's Tooth, and we'll talk about Willow or the Beartooth Unit in a future slide here. And obviously out to the east, we're seeing we've seen production from the Badami Unit, Point Thompson Unit. We've seen exploration recently out on the eastern side of the North Slope oil-producing area, and hopefully we'll see some more development activity there in the future.
Chair Freer, John Crowther, for the record, I'll jump in occasionally on these slides just to add a little more commentary. We'll go into detail in the next slide, but of course, you'd expect when you see a field with that volume of production, that lifespan, you know, 40, 50 years of operation, geologically those fields are very mature. They're on the tail end of production. And so the production rates we still see, and the fact that we, as we discuss in our production forecast presentation, that those fields are both Kuparuk River and Prudhoe Bay either flat or seeing an increase in production relative to their total volume, is a testament to a lot of investment and activity. And it's also a reason why it's so important to have new fields, new developments on the slope, because our anchor, you know, anchor supplies are at an advanced age for an oil field, and we need to expand the production stock to continue to see the levels that we're seeing, and we need to drive our economy. Fortunately, right now we're seeing that, so that's where we come in with a good news story.
This is a graph that basically shows the history of North Slope oil production from its inception in 1977 to today. And obviously you can kind of see it, production peaked back in the late 1980s at around 2 million barrels of oil per day. That's what the X or the Y axis on the left shows. Obviously, if you look at the graph, the majority of the production has come from Prudhoe Bay and quite a bit from Kuparuk River, and then the other sort of satellite fields kind of filling in the remainder. One thing I will point out to you that's pretty obvious is after that 2 million barrel a day peak, fairly precipitous decline down to, say, in the kind of 2006 to 2010 range, where production more or less is, I guess you'd say, stabilized at around, you know, the 400 to 600,000 barrel per day rates. To stabilize that decline, though, however, I don't know how recognized it is, requires an incredible amount of activity from development drilling, infill drilling, facilities, optimization, maintenance, well work, you know, workovers to keep wells online, keep their capability of production, you know, going, because they do kind of wear out and fail at times. So there's, you know, even though the production's flat, there's still an incredible amount of capital and expense investment into these fields to make production flat.
Chair, again, John Crowther for the record, and members of the committee, I just well summarized by my colleague. I would note that a point that I've been making in several forums recently is that when you look at our production curve history, you can argue with a field of this size, the startup period really was, you know, Prudhoe Bay obviously coming online in the late 1970s, Kuparuk coming online shortly thereafter, a very long kind of plateau startup period. But since that peak, we have not seen an increase in our production the entire history of the state. And when we go into a little bit more detail in the next slide with our production forecast, we're seeing a measurable increase within the next 10-year period, 20-30% increase. So that is truly unprecedented in our entire history.
Sorry, we have a question from Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair. The difference, just to kind of drive home this point, the Kuparuk River production has not, it appears from the graph, that it has not decreased as precipitously as Prudhoe Bay. Relatively slower decrease. Is that just the characteristics of the field, or?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Prax. For the record, I'm Derek Nottingham. I think, yeah, the two fields do have quite different characteristics, and I would say that the Kuparuk River field has, you know, has its main development, but also there have been quite a few satellite developments that the operator there, Conoco, have progressed aggressively over time. It is a Kuparuk reservoir, if you will. That's the age of the reservoir. Prudhoe Bay is what's called the Ivishak reservoir. So they are two different geologic formations. The fluid characteristics in them are quite different as well. Prudhoe Bay has a enormous gas cap, and so that precipitous decline that you see at Prudhoe Bay is a result of a lot of gas breakthrough and being able to handle that gas in the facilities and keep the oil production going. So different geology and also just a different makeup of the fluids, I think, contributes to the difference in the kind of the decline rates that you see there.
All right, thank you. I think we got to get through this, and then there might be some more fun questions.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Representative Prox. Seeing no further questions, you can proceed to the next slide.
Yeah, for the record, Derek Nottingham. So this, like John mentioned, going forward, we are actually forecasting an increase in production over the next 10 years, starting with actually from fiscal year 2026, which is the year we're in, to fiscal year 2027. So we're starting to actually realize a lot of the benefit from projects like PICA coming online. So just to explain the graph in a nutshell, what you see is our high and low and official forecast that went into the fall 2025 forecast this year. The official forecast has us roughly at around 465,000 barrels of oil per day on average for fiscal year 2026, with an increase of up over nearly 520,000 barrels a day for fiscal year 2027. As I mentioned, that is a large part due to PICA coming online. We're expecting PICA to come online at the end of March, early April, with a period of several months of ramp up from about 30,000 barrels a day up to max capacity of the Nanushuk production facility of 80,000 barrels a day by the summer, maybe early fall of this year. And you know, as we move forward into the future, we expect to continue to see production from PICA kind of stabilizing, and then in 2029, expecting to see Willow coming online, adding a significant number of barrels there. And then there are some other projects that we'll talk about in a future slide to kind of give a flavor of what else is going into the official forecast. I will point out that there is an operator forecast line that's on the graph. That operator forecast comes from confidential conversations, information that we obtain from the operators, compile it, and put it together. It's a totally independent assessment of production than what we do. However, it is interesting to note that we're fairly close, in fairly close alignment with what the operators are saying, with the exception that the operator forecast doesn't, as it says down at the bottom, doesn't include the future projects that are already that are outside of currently producing units. So projects like Pika and Willow won't be in that dashed forecast or that dashed projection there.
Thank you. Representative Souther?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll keep it quick so we can keep moving progress. I'm glad to see the forecast for increased production. I'm a little chagrined to see the operators' somewhat more pessimistic forecast, but and it's not as if people should think we can go down to zero or 100,000 barrels a day. Would the director speak to the operational limits of the pipeline operating below what we have as the forecasts? Is there any generally understood floor when it becomes more operationally challenging to operate the taps?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I don't have a specific number right offhand of what that floor may be, but in general, there is a low flow sort of limit on production through taps. Higher flow rates mean higher heat through the line. So as production drops through the line, the oil tends to cool off much faster, and that will cause basically it to develop like a waxy kind of material and basically plug up the line. And so there is a limit. I think the pipeline operator Alyeska has worked on various ways to even make sure that we can go to lower limits or lower production if necessary. Right now at 480,000 barrels a day, that's not a concern. I don't want to venture to guess like what that number is, but it's significantly below that, I'd say.
Representative Crox.
Yeah, just to share work experience on that very same thing, that the 10, 15 years ago, somebody said, we're going to go below 500,000 barrels a day. This was never designed to go below 500,000 barrels a day. And they have spent tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars dealing with the low flow and figuring out how to do it. So it can go way below 500,000, but it becomes much more expensive to operate. It's cheaper to operate it at 550 than 450 by a lot because of the heat.
Chair, just very, very briefly on that topic, John Crowther for the record. Representative Prax, thank you for that point, and it's absolutely very relevant to the state from our royalty valuation. We essentially, the fixed operational and of costs of taps is spread across the shippers through the tariff. If the tariff goes up, our royalty value goes down. Consequently, if the tariff goes down, our royalty value goes up. So more oil in the pipeline means all of our royalty oil gets more valuable. And that's one of the very significant commercial concerns with these low flow scenarios, in addition to the just operational concerns. I will say I've worked at the department for some time. I've worked when there's been real commercial and technical concerns about the trend, when we saw a trend of 7, 8, 10% decline per year about these operational things. I can share, I've been approached by individuals, companies looking at investment in Alaska who have raised concerns about capacity for increase. Are we going to have space in the line given modifications to adapt to low flow? If we do see, as indicated on this chart, 600,000, 700,000, 800,000 barrels per day, are we going to have room to get our project in? And that's a very different problem and a very good problem to have. So it's been a real change in my time at DNR.
Yeah. For the record, Derek Nottingham again. This map is very busy, and I will try not to read through every one of the bubbles here. But just to kind of characterize what this represents is the activity that we've seen on the North Slope, and it's very busy, and that's a very good thing. There's a lot of new development, like we mentioned at Pika and Willow. There's a lot of activity in the legacy fields to to reinvigorate production, and we'll talk about some of those activities in a future slide. There's exploration success to reference at the Lanyap Sockeye 2 that we have seen some success out there on the east side of the North Slope. There's future exploration wells that are planned in the NPRA for this winter season. So there's a lot of activity going on. I'll highlight a few things. One is Hillcorp Alaska continues to really perform well in the Milne Point field, in the Prudhoe Bay field, basically reversing decline there and doing significant development activity. Willow Project is on its way. ConocoPhillips is not only doing the Willow Project, but kind of a lot behind the scenes progressing projects within the Colville River unit, within the Kuparuk River unit, that are just maybe an additional pad, maybe a pad expansion, or just a new PA that they're developing. So they continue to adjust and navigate just within their existing assets as well, and continue to find oil there and produce it. If there are any other questions on this, I'll be glad to address them.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Director Nottingham, I see the Agnew activity. I've always thought that the heavy oil, viscous oil production is kind of our next cleanup, next frontier. Any progress in the technology or the operations that would help produce viscous oil?
Through the chair, for the record, Derek Nottingham, Representative Sadler. I do believe that Hillcorp has tested and drilled a few Agnew wells. They have been fairly successful in doing that. I think one of the things that we are learning from, they are learning from, is the use of polymer flooding to basically make water that they use for injection and support in the reservoir more viscous, and what's called a better mobility ratio between the injected fluid and the produced fluid. So it basically helps stabilize the flood, the recovery, the production, if you will. And so they've been testing that and using that in their Schrader Bluff development. So that has a lot of promise for, I'd say, heavy oil development on the North Slope. And they've been very successful at that so far.
Representative Hall,
thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm curious. Could you please talk a little bit about the box in the top right where it mentioned specifically POSCO International Corporation? I'm not familiar with that company.
Yeah, Representative Hall, through the chair. This is John Crowther. I think the best and most authoritative kind of source on the companies involved would be Glenfarne and or AGDC, but it's our understanding that POSCO is a South Korean, I believe, steel company, very large, very involved, and I think their partnership with AGDC involves both potential participatory interest in the project, but also supplying important materials to it. So I may need to double-check and correct that, but I believe that's correct.
Seeing no further questions. I do actually have a question. So we saw a presentation a couple of days ago from Gaffney Klein, and they talked about once we start producing the gas and how that affects the economics of further oil production. Do you see, or are you following that? Are there trends? What are your thoughts?
Chair Freer, through yourself, I always mumble that one. John Crowther, for the record. There's a couple of very important dynamics there. The first that's commonly talked about is as Director Nottingham referenced earlier, the gas, Prudhoe Bay, some folks call it a gas field. The gas pressurization is very important to ultimate oil recovery. So you have to manage gas offtake in light of overall field pressures and the distribution of those throughout the reservoir. There's a tremendous amount of work in modeling, understanding the reservoir, water flooding, adjusting the pressure. For reference to the committee, historically when folks were looking at this project, the AOGCC, which is directly responsible for that, did carefully assess this issue and issued an approved offtake for gas at a time this project was at a different iteration. And so that work has continued. The companies, the operators, the department also follows that and pays close attention to it. I think one of the things that Gaffney Klein may have been referencing, which is also a very positive thing for the state, is that when you have additional resources that can be produced from the same infrastructure, you can spread that capital cost, extend that life, and economically advantage that recovery. And that's one of the things that is a little bit of a new frontier for the state, is if a given camp, a production facility, doesn't have to stand on the oil economics alone, but there's also gas recovery, its useful life may be 25 years instead of 7. And so that is a boon, we think, potentially, not well understood yet. But when we move to large-scale gas commercialization, there's a lot of second-order and follow-on effects that are very positive for the economics for producers and for the state in extending that life. So it's an exciting thing to learn more about.
Thank you. Representative Mears, then Representative Prox.
Thank you, through the chair. Thanks for being here. It's always good to layer on the information because it's a lot, and you guys specialize in it, and we dabble, even though we have some pretty big responsibilities with it. I would like to know more about what the gas situation is up on the North Slope. And if you guys have data compiled on that, that would be fantastic. Quality, quantities, you know, whether it's being utilized for enhanced oil recovery, and just a better feel for that. I mean, we're getting into that on the North Slope a little bit more specifically on the oil part. But, you know, as we're looking at, you know, beneficially utilizing the gas up there, what does that look like? I guess I'm imagining there's that information in pockets and pieces, at least at DNR, but I would love to have a little bit of that data sorting, and so it's easier for my brain to put it in context.
Through the chair, John Crowther here, Representative Mears, would be happy to work with the committee and share more information on that.
Thank you. Representative Prox?
I am happy to report that others are stealing my questions.
Welcome to resources.
Yes.
Thank you. Representative or co-chair Diver.
Thank you, co-chair. Through the co-chair, I don't know who can answer this, just because I live in Fairbanks, and Fairbanks is on one of these little graphs. And I'm just curious, have you been to Harvest Alaska plant, and just kind of what is that like? And that'd be great. Thank you.
Co-chair Dibert, John Crowther for the record. I have not personally toured the plant. We've, at the department, we've been following it very closely because it's important, one, just from the opportunity to provide a secure supply of gas, obviously. It monetized a small amount of gas, which is a good thing. And as we'll talk about later in the presentation, that gas supply for Fairbanks is currently coming from Cook Inlet. And so, you know, a small move away from Cook Inlet helps lower the pressure for some of those other demands. So we view that as a very positive project. I believe it's operational now, but Director Nottingham may have more details there.
Co-chair Dibert, through the chair, for the record, Derek Nottingham. I've been to the plant when it was in its construction phase. It's on, I believe it was formerly called the Otna pad, which was an existing pad. It shares that piece of land with another operation that's going on there, or maybe happening in the future. But it basically takes gas from the Prudhoe Bay field and chills it and extracts the liquids out of that chilled gas to create LNG, and they basically load it onto trucks and send it down the Dalton Highway to Fairbanks.
Thank you.
Oh, Representative Prox?
Thank you. Through the chair, as long as we're on this same slide. The Great Bear Pantheon project. I have heard that there is a source of gas from there, that it's pipeline quality gas, doesn't require all the conditioning. I haven't heard anything about that in the last 6 months or so. Have you heard anything about that?
Representative Prox, through the chair, John Crowther for the record, and I may let the director supplement this a little bit. You know, that project has been working on a series of exploration and characterization wells. They did drill one this year. I believe they're still reviewing and processing those results. They put some information out about it. I think they continue to work to understand the reservoir. The nature of their development is a little different than some of the other fields. And so they've been trying to learn to understand the reservoir, the nature of the charge, and the volume of the charge there. So I think that work continues, and I think they're continuing to be active discussing their project both with, you know, potential buyers of gas but also investors and the market to assess their kind of next steps for more wells and more exploration activity, more okay. characterization activity.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Souther?
Thank you. To the chair, probably to Derek's best question. We heard some good news from the governor and from Glenn Farn yesterday about the prospects for natural gas production and delivery. And the question I'd like to raise is, what is the likely earliest source or source of early gas for a gas pipeline for phase one, which we're hearing encouraging words said about? Where would that gas likely come from?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, there are several different options, I would say, on the table. Prudhoe Bay has the most gas. However, it has a very, when I say very high, it has a CO2 content that's, I think, around 12% or so. So that CO2 is very hard to handle for a phase one gas pipeline, probably, you know, rules that out. So as I understand the project teams, they're looking for gas that has a low CO2 content. So there, we think, are a few different sources for a lower CO2 content, not necessarily zero, but not quite as high as Prudhoe Bay. One might be gas potentially from the North Star unit, potentially from Point Thompson. You know, Point Thompson's been a big part of past gas line efforts, and it has, we think, somewhere around, you know, 6 to 10 TCF of gas available and a fairly low CO2 content. It is quite a bit removed from infrastructure and would require, you know, a pipeline in and of itself. So,
to the chair, I've heard that Glenn Farn is envisioning that spur line out to Point Thompson for gas as part of their phase one scope. Thanks.
Seeing no further questions.
So, for the record, Derek Nottingham. This next slide just basically describes our fall 2025 lease sale on the North Slope. It was one of the best that we've had in quite a while, which is a testament to the success that we've seen a lot in a large part in the Nanushuk Reservoir, which is what Pika and Santos are developing, what Conoco is developing out in Willow. And so we've seen a lot of activity and a lot of renewed interest in what's called the Brookian-aged section of geology. Essentially, the results from this lease sale, $17.5 million in bonus bids. That's the highest that we have seen since prior to COVID. So in 2018, there were 287 tracts that were sold, around 500,000 acres. That's the most land lease since 2014. So a very good lease sale by all respects this past fall. If you look off to the bottom right, that gives you an indication of the companies, and the colors there are represented in the lease blocks above, so you can kind of see where different companies have been bidding and the lease acreage positions they're acquiring.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I'll keep it quick. It's always good to get money. The bonus money will be spent well, I'm sure. But this is actually a down payment in future production. So, and there's lots of nuance and English that comes from these kind of things. From your perspective as an industry professional, characterize what do you take from this lease sale? Is this mostly step out work? Is this pioneering? How should we interpret and understand the results of this lease sale?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I would say this is it's definitely kind of an extension of the success that's been seen by, you know, in the Brookian plays. So as I mentioned, you know, the Pico development is the Nushuk Reservoir. It's a Brookian play. I think a lot of companies are seeing that success and seeing the availability, proximity to infrastructure, and really kind of looking at these leases in the North Slope in a different light. As you see, you know, the renewed production on the North Slope being commercialized, you know, it obviously creates that interest, you know, and then further south down towards the Alcade, Talitha, Tulik River units, those exploratory wells there, they've seen light oil, they've seen you know, potentially very big resources, so I think companies are also interested in those kind of plays. The oil resources here on the North Slope are immense. As you saw from the production, we're at 19.2 billion barrels. There could be quite a bit more to go out there and explore for and develop. And so that's, I think, what we're seeing is, you know, just a response to the success that we're seeing from the other fields.
Okay. Thank you.
Jeffrey, just very briefly, John Crowther for the record, I know we need to move along in our presentation, but I, you know, one of the other dynamics just to note for the committee, all the green squares on that map are already leased. And so, you know, when we have a record-setting lease sale or a very high results lease sale, when we have that level of current lease tracts issued, is just a sign, a very good sign, because we – all those other green tracks we're seeing activity, exploration, and characterization work on as well. So we're pretty well leased up.
Thank you. There's a question for Representative Hall.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the Co-Chair, I'm wondering if you could put it in perspective a little more. I see on the slide here we're talking about since 2018, but I guess over the overall history, or I guess in modern history, when it comes to leases on the North Slope, where do these leases compare to leases maybe in the 80s or 90s? Like, everything's relative, right? So I guess I'm trying to understand, like, more as far as, like, how significant this is, especially when it comes to the cost per acre, if that's even a way to measure it.
Representative Hall, John Crowther for the record, through the chair. We can share some kind of historical statistical information with the committee for reference. I think one of the dynamics, as I was alluding to before, we've had huge lease sales in the past when there's been a very new geologic kind of theory or our original lease sale, obviously an order of magnitude larger than this, even in those days' dollars. But what makes the department so excited about seeing a lease sale with this magnitude is how much acreage we currently have leased. You know, we know many of these areas were taken for lease in the last year, last 2-3 years. And so when we see this level of activity on top of what's already out there, I think that's why we view this as such a good result. But we'll share that statistical information for the committee.
Through the chair, this is Derek Nottingham for the record. So to kind of follow on the lease sale, what felt like it was appropriate to talk about was the potential upcoming lease sales in the federal lease areas, so in MPRA, in ANWR, and also in the Cook Inlet. So there's a lot going on in this slide, and I'll try to summarize it as best I can. But the One Big Beautiful Bill did compel the Department of Interior to basically reinstate its lease sale program in the federal areas, which includes obviously Alaska. So the BOEM, or Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, is going to conduct a lease sale fairly soon here, March 4th, in the Cook Inlet, in the OCS waters of the Cook Inlet. So they've modified the royalty terms for those new leases down to 12.5%, and they do plan on having up to five more sales through 2032 after this first one. And yeah, so this is that's exciting news. It supplements our desire or hope for more gas to be explored for out of the Cook Inlet.
Representative Elam, do you have a question?
Thank you. Appreciate the presentation. Yeah. Talking about the Cook Inlet, and just kind of curious what the state is doing as well to I guess make sure that the Cook Inlet oil in particular, we talk about Cook Inlet natural gas a lot, but making sure that Cook Inlet oil is also a priority. It's great to see that the feds are stepping in on some of that, but I know with things like Marathon, for example, our refinery out there, they have the not, you know, it's built for Cook Inlet oil, right? And that produces a ton of jet fuel, everything up into the interior and around. So just making sure it's still a priority.
Representative Elam, through the chair, John Crowther here for the record. It's absolute. We do talk a great deal about Cook Inlet natural gas, but we follow the oil production quite closely. One of the things we addressed in our production forecast is that Cook Inlet oil production continues to decline, and that's in part because of the necessity for operators to be pursuing gas, in part because of the age of the fields. But one of the things we have done at the department level to try and incent new activity in the inlet is offered highly competitive, what we call net profit share leases. So that's where companies are only responsible for paying into the state once they reach profitability, so they recoup their costs. And that's something we did to incent both oil and gas activity. We've seen a limited number of those leases taken up yet and not that much activity on them, but we're working to continue to offer those and do everything we can to make sure oil production remains robust.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. To the chair, to Commissioner Crowther. So the Cook Inlet lease sales, is that royalty reduction just for that first sale, or does that carry through to the rest of the six sales? And second, any estimation as to how effective that might be in enticing bids in the Cook Inlet?
Representative Sadler, through the chair. I may be misstating the federal law, but I believe that sets that royalty for the sale program going forward. So it would be that sale and the future sales, but can work to confirm that for the committee. The on the question of interest, I think we're hopeful that that'll drive some interest, but it still is a challenge in the Cook Inlet, and that's driven. It's a complex market, and it's also challenged by potentially federal permitting. And so, you know, there are some federal leases today. We're hopeful we'll see some activity in the near term on those and be able to see successful permitting for that activity. But that's part of why the department's been doing everything we can with our authorities on our state acreage, because we know we can't depend on the federal acreage, unfortunately.
Through the chair, for the record, Derek Nottingham, to kind of move on from Cook Inlet and talk about the onshore North Slope Bureau of Land Management areas of authority, MPRA and ANWR, we're anxiously awaiting a sale announcement. They're required to make that first sale by July 4th and to administer four more sales through 2032 as well. And so what the division is doing is in both the Cook Inlet sale as well as BLM sales on the North Slope is try to coordinate our lease sales with them as much as possible. So there's just a kind of a swelling of interest in Alaska all at one time, whether it's on federal leases or on state leases. And so that's kind of what those two bottom bullet points indicate there. We have already made plans to coordinate our Cook Inlet lease sale on state leases with the upcoming Cook Inlet sale by BOEM. And because of the timing and our previous sale being just this past fall, we may hold a special sale that coincides with the BLM activity on the North Slope.
Well, Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair on that. Does the department think about leasing properties now to get current income versus looking ahead 10, 20 years, what the market might be, and is our leasing schedule, what drives our leasing schedule, I guess?
Representative Prox, through the chair, John Crowther for the record. The department does a fair amount of effort to understand, you know, when we offer leases, we want to offer them for a long enough time that an entity is able to do the work necessary to develop them, but also a tight enough time that we don't have warehousing or acreage sitting kind of fallow without work. We also include things like rental step-ups later in the lease, potential extensions versus shorter primary terms. So we evaluate a lot of different variables to try and strike the best balance, and we vary those across location. You know, highly prospective areas, we may include a shorter term or a higher royalty or both. And so that's it. The department works very carefully to have what we think is a balanced lease approach that protects our interest, accelerates development while letting folks have competitive terms that will attract bidding. So I hope that answers your question.
Sort of. All I can really think to compare it to is the housing market. But there is, if you're a real estate developer, rental properties, you can get too many on the market today, and therefore you're hurting your long-term prospects. On the other hand, who knows what's going to happen in the future? I'm optimistic for, we've got to get through a short period, then we're going to have pretty decent income from the state. One of the things that happened with Prudhoe Bay was, frankly, there was probably too much income coming on the front end, and then that income fell off over the last 15 years or so, and we are where we are, kind of because we overinvested in not so much the leases. That just happened, but we built a lot of facilities that we are having long-time trouble maintaining. Maybe a little more something to talk about offline, maybe future discussion. I don't know.
Representative Prax, through the chair, happy to discuss it. I think, in short summary, we think the front stage of making leases available, there's not a risk that we're flooding the market, so to speak.
Okay. Yeah. All right. We're not going to get too much money.
Thank you.
Through the chair, for the record, this is Derek Nottingham again. We're kind of transitioning out of the lease sale results and future plans for lease sales into a little bit more of some operational and status updates on projects. So the first one here is a production chart that shows our Milne Point unit, which is currently operated by Hillcorp, but was previously operated by BP from the early 90s up until 2014. And so on the chart, what you see is the production rate over time. And you see, you know, back when BP did the primary development, fairly high production rate, 50,000 barrels a day. The peak at nearly 59,000 barrels a day back in 1998, and then a precipitous decline as you see the blue dash line there, water production coming up. So the water in the reservoir is basically moving through and pushing that oil out, but then it basically moves through and it moves better than the oil in a lot of cases. And so oil declines. And down to around 18, 19,000 barrels by the time BP transferred the asset or sold the asset to Hilcorp. So very precipitous decline. Hilcorp took over from that point, stabilized production, and as you can see in the last 5 to 10 years has really ramped up production to the point where you're almost at that equivalent primary development peak. So right now they're at a little over 50,000 barrels a day. What's unique about this is that the oil that they're producing today is predominantly what's called the Schrader Bluff formation. So it's a little bit thicker, more viscous oil. It's harder to move. And so we talked about polymer injection earlier. They're doing what's called polymer injection, and they're drilling a lot of relatively closely spaced horizontal producer-injector pairs in the Schrader Bluff, and they really are getting after it quite a bit. To use a bit of a colloquialism, and they they've really kind of turned that decline around. It's very rare that you see a mature field like this actually hit a second peak after redevelopment. That's almost the equivalent of its, kind of primary peak plateau production. So outstanding job here by the operator. And the other interesting point I'll make before I move on is that Hilcorp recently acquired Eni, an Italian oil company's assets on the North Slope. They used to operate the Nikaichuk and Ugarit units. And so those units have basically the same formation, the same kind of development in them, same type of oil. And so, I don't want to make any promises for Hilcorp, but they have their eyes on those fields to kind of do some of the similar techniques there. And, hopefully we see something fairly similar to this in those fields, or, even half of the, half of this kind of impact would be a brilliant thing to see. So, this next slide is a bit of an update on Pikka. So Pikka Phase 1 is very close to complete. Commissioning works already underway, and so production is expected at the end of first quarter. So right around end of March, early April, we expect to see production coming online from Pikka. You see on the map just where the Pikka project is. So just for reference, the Kuparuk River unit is kind of the top right corner, and you move west and there the Nanushuk production facilities there in the on the green road that you see labeled MPF. The initial pad for Pikka Phase 1 is NDB, so Nanushuk drill site B. They've drilled 25 of the 45 wells already or have been drilled on the NDB pad. They've got obviously another 20 or so wells to continue drilling. They've got the production modules in place, the seawater treatment plant in place, and so we're right at the cusp of bringing on one of the biggest new oil developments that we've seen on the North Slope in quite a while, probably since back in the early 2000s, maybe even before that. So very good progress there. They continue to mature their phase two, and I understand that, if you were an oil company, you kind of want to see how this investment goes and how things progress and if things are kind of producing the way you'd hope they would and expect they would before you make the next significant investment. So I think there's going to be a period of time before phase two goes forward. Don't think it's going to be very long. We expect good things out of Pikka from what we've seen. Things are kind of coming in as expected. bit of an update on Willow. Willow is about 50% completed and remains on track for first production in early 2029. They've done a lot of activity in the past winter season, constructing two bridges, installing 72 miles of pipelines west of Kuparik. They've got a big plans for this winter for gravel on remaining drill sites, installing two remaining bridges, continued pipeline work, opening up the Willow permanent camp, and they've made major progress on the central production facility modules that are currently under construction, and they'll be transported up to the slope within, you know, in 2027. That project is expected to see a peak rate of 180,000 barrels of oil per day and has ultimate estimated oil over its life of about 600 million barrels of oil.
Representative Sadler, then Representative Fields.
Through the chair, so I see on the legend there is ASRC lease and state lease and then ASRC slash state lease. What is a ASRC slash state lease? What's the relationship there?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, very quickly, and I John Crowther for the record, I may not fully capture the history here, but when the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act occurred, regional corporations were established and had the right to receive lands within their relative regions. Because of the status of land positions with the federal withdrawals and state actions selections on the North Slope, there were limitations on ASRC receiving their full allotment of lands at that time. So there was a negotiated settlement agreement where the state and ASRC essentially jointly own some lands in the subsurface, and that's the yellow color on that map. So under that settlement agreement, for those leases, there's an allocation of royalty between the two parties. So some particular sections have a very high percentage for one, some the other. For reference for the committee, obviously some of those leases underlie the PICA unit. The kind of state overall net royalty interest is probably between 10-11%, and you know that'll be subject to the actual final production and how it comes out. But that's a longstanding settlement. I think that was reached at some point in the 1980s.
Thanks,
Representative Fields.
Thank you. Through the chair, the State Department of Labor tracks Alaska hire rates in different industries and reports on an annual basis. I was curious if the department, perhaps in partnership with other departments, tracks Alaska hire rates on specific projects. My impression is that Alaska hire rates were actually pretty good in terms of pipeline construction, Willow and PICA. But as we try to understand what drives these long-term trends of either growth or reduction in Alaska hire rates industry-wide, can we also track that on in these individual units and try to understand what produces better outcomes? Thank you.
Representative Fields, through the chair, John Crowther for the record, we'd be happy to talk with the Department of Labor, see the granularity of the data, and see if it's something we can do either by operator or by area.
And just for the committee, the schedule for next week has come out, but we will be hearing from Conoco, Santos, and Hillcorp next week on Wednesday. So you can ask those companies individually.
To the chair, for the record, Derek Nottingham again. Now, I'll just point, just to reference the map one more time, the Willow project is those three pads that indicate BT1 or Beartooth 1, Beartooth 2, Beartooth 3. Those are the three drill pads, and it's within the Beartooth unit. So they're further to the west of the Greater Moose's Tooth unit. This next slide is a summary of all the future projects that we see coming down the pipe. We've already talked about PICA and Willow, and as we mentioned, you know, PICA, once phase two is kind of implemented and online, potentially up to 160,000 barrels a day. Willow has an estimated peak rate of 180,000 barrels a day. So that really is a lot of the good news story in our production forecast and you know, bright future ahead of us. But some of the other projects that are going on that don't get as much notoriety, but definitely can add to that production peak in the future. The Colville River CD8 project is one that is a new pad that could potentially be, our estimate, up to 20,000 barrels a day. It's east of the village of Nuiqsut. There are, you know, just considering the location, a lot of, you know, stakeholder engagement type questions. What's the best way to develop those resources and you know, and mitigate any impacts that you know, come with developing in those areas. So that project is expected to be online in by 2030. But that is one that the Corps of Engineers has recently created its notice of intent. That was back in September, and meaning they're in the process of drafting an EIS and planning on issuing that record of decision later this year or early next year. The next project down on the bottom is the PBU or Prudhoe Bay Project Taiga. It's basically two pads called the Omega Pad and I Pad. This is out on the western side of Prudhoe. It basically, if you kind of look at the geology, it's more Schrader Bluff development like we've seen in Milne Point where we saw that production curve. They've basically turned it around. So this is Hillcorp kind of doing its magic, going back into a mature area of the reservoir of the field, developing the thicker viscous oil, and hopefully we'll see really good things from that project as well. Peak rate expected to be 40,000 barrels a day when both pads are online. This next slide is it's very busy here, I understand. It basically shows some of the exploration work that ConocoPhillips is planning this winter in PRA. Just those exploration wells, the four of them are the Tinnick 3, the Kaviak 2, the Tinnimiac, I apologize if I don't say it right, Tinnimiac, yeah, 19, and then the, I believe it's the Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. The other two wells that you see indicated on the map are wells that are old exploration wells that are planned to be P&A'd. They're also going to shoot a seismic survey over some of the southern parts of the established units. So this one is currently being litigated. Some environmental groups have challenged the BLM decision that authorized Conoco to do this program. The state has intervened in that particular case and opposed the preliminary injunction that those environmental groups have sought. And yeah, we're just basically awaiting the decision at this point.
When do you anticipate to hear a decision?
Chair Freer, it's possible that decision has been issued during this hearing, essentially imminently.
Go ahead.
Any day now is the best answer, yeah.
I'm sorry?
Any day now, John Crowther, for the record. Any day now.
Thank you.
Through the chair, for the record, this is Derek Nottingham. So we'll transition into Cook Inlet gas and why it's so important, and then talk a bit about the kind of the production forecast that we've done and a little bit of about the activity that's going on. So why is Cook Inlet gas so important? Well, that gas goes to serve about 70% of Alaska's population in terms of heating and electricity. So NSTAR provides a lot of that gas that's used for heating. About 440,000 people over 25 communities. Also, the Interior Gas Utility that serves about 2,400 people. Apologies. That we talked about the Harvest LNG project earlier is now supplying IGU with North Slope gas, so that does alleviate some of the pressure off of the Cook Inlet system. And then on the electric side, Chugach Electric serves around 300,000 people. Matanuska Electric serves around 180,000 people. over the South Central area, as well as Homer, serving around 36,000 people. So a lot of people were really affected in terms of their livelihood, their homes, their businesses, by the, you know, Cook Inlet gas and the potential, you know, impending shortages that we see in the future. The other thing to note here is the long-term contracts and when they expire for each of the different utilities there. The chart on the right basically just shows the uses of that gas in terms of which utilities use the gas. So NSTAR uses about 50% of it. The other 50% or 40% or so, yeah, 50% is MEA, Chugach, and Matanuska Electric, and then IGU about 6%. But like we said, some of that's there's going to be some reduction in that, so that's a good thing.
Representative Mears?
Thank you, through the chair. So on that last slide, so Homer Electric Association's contract ran out already on the direct gas supply and is being served now through NSTAR's contract. And then I think it was just last week, Matanuska Electric has extended their contract through 2029. So there's a little bit of very recent changes on there. But yeah, it's coming soon. And so that's the more important part of the slide here.
Through the chair, Representative Mears, yeah, thank you for that. Supplementing that, yes, there is a response that we're seeing in the Cook Inlet, and we'll talk about that in the next slide, to the potential shortfall. And so, yeah, we are seeing contracts being renegotiated and those type of things happening. So that is a good thing, but the bad news story, I guess, that we saw back in 2022 is shown on this slide. In 2022, Hillcorp basically announced roughly in April that it would continue to supply gas to meet its existing contracts, but basically said that into the future the assets were getting so depleted that they were not going to commit to extending those contracts long term into the future. So at that point we put together a forecast of what the supply would look like relative to the what we understood to be the demand for the Cook Inlet gas. So that top line demand number is around 70 BCF per year. That's the amount of gas that's required to feed the electrical utility demand, the heating utility demand, plus any field and industrial demand like fuel gas usage for oil and gas operations or fuel gas usage for the Marathon refinery. So that's kind of the demand breakdown for the Cook Inlet gas. And what you see there is this forecast and those blue bars represent the annual volumes that we estimated from the existing fields plus the existing fields and wells and the ongoing development drilling that was going on primarily by Hillcorp at about 15 wells per year. And you see this precipitous drop off in the 26-27 time frame, and then, you know, a lot of white space out there at the, you know, towards the tail end of the graph. So the interesting thing here is that this has actually been shown through multiple studies before the 2022 study that we did, that towards the middle to end of the 2020s, that this was kind of going to happen. So it's been forecasted before.
Oh, Representative Prox?
Through the chair. Where is Cook Inlet? South Indiana, that's right. Okay, yeah. On your graph, they are not signing long-term contracts, but that doesn't necessarily mean, boom, the gas shuts off the next day. Correct?
Representative practice through the chair. That's correct. You know, there's fixed contract volumes. There's also gas sold in the spot market outside of contracts at times. I would note this is dated to 2022. This is historical information at this time, but this is about production, not necessarily contracted volumes, this chart.
Okay. And follow-up, if I may? Mm-hmm. That does that assume at today's price, if the price changes, price goes up, maybe there's more available?
Representative Prax, through the chair, John Crowther again for the record, that's right. This effort in 2022, now historical, did not include a price variability that naturally would affect supply and demand. What we're able to see in the next slide is a little bit how the market's evolved and the supply has evolved.
Okay, that might be the next question. Because I guess the next question, gas line shows up. That changes, kind of makes, in my mind, cook inlet obsolete. I don't know if that's true or not. But anyway, that was going to be the next question. But that might come in this slide. I'll wait.
Okay.
Through the chair, for the record, Derek Nottingham. So the next slide really shows some of the activity that and change that we've seen since 2022. So it's a fairly positive story, I'd say. What you're seeing is those same blue bars, but what we've seen is a shift of even the blue bars above the 70 BCF for the next 5 years or so, even in the 2030. So the existing operators, existing producers, primarily Hilcorp, have done a lot of work to optimize their drilling program to focus in on areas where they are having the most success. For instance, at the Beluga River field, at North Cook Inlet field, and some other areas where they have just been able to drill better wells. And so we're seeing the impacts of that. Those orange bars that you see are some of the new gas that we're seeing come online with Fury Hex drilling at the Kitchen Lights field, and also potentially expecting some gas to come online from the Cosmopolitan field in the future. When you see those purple bars kind of showing up there in the 2032, 2033, 2034 time frame, what that is a recognition that the system only uses about 70 BCF, so any overage of 70 BCF in the near term, we assume gets injected into storage and stored for long-term use into the future. So that purple is just kind of gas coming out of storage as the fields go on that decline. Another main point from this slide is that the Cook Inlet still eventually does go on decline, and there still is this white space out there. If it's the line from the North Slope coming in, there's definitely a window here and a bridge that the Cook Inlet gas fills, and then obviously a need for the North Slope gas to fill that white space into the future. So I would say, to answer your question, Rep. Prox, we hope and we see a future for both Cook Inlet gas and North Slope gas.
Representative Fields?
Thank you, through the chair, following up on that question. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm guessing this question is unanswerable at this time because we don't know the price from which Instar would be buying gas from a pipeline where there's not a gas sales agreement yet, but if there becomes one, then I would certainly be interested in understanding the cost of that, the cost for their buyers, and how that would relate to, say, you know, the gas that NSTAR is buying from Hex at $13.50 per MCF. Because I agree with you, I can see an environment where actually utilities are using both, or maybe the gas from the pipeline really is a lot cheaper. So just tracking that, I think, in the future would be helpful. Thank you.
Representative Mears?
Thank you, through the chair. So I am happy to see the purple on there. So resources in the 33rd legislature was kind of front lines for doing a lot of new legislation to support that, and the utilities are, and producers have really taken that up, and we keep hearing new news about that storage increasing. Dugatch Electric this fall also gave an update to legislators showing their changes, and of course they've got the Beluga Field, which is their part owners with, that is kind of outside of their contract with Hillcorp, even being partners there. So we're seeing a little bit of being able to look off into the future and seeing some other things kind of filling some of that white space. We have been getting information, you know, Fury Hex having a successful summer. I've heard that Blue Crest is under new ownership. I haven't gotten any background on any potential increased production there. Do you guys have any more information? Have they updated their plan of development or given you new ideas on what their production might, of course, absent a new platform?
Yeah, Representative Mears through the chair, John Crowther for the record here. So maybe addressing the last or most specific question there at the end, at this time the department has not processed transfer of ownership or new ownership for the Bluecrest entity, owner and operator of the Cosmopolitan Field. That field right now is in default pending a potential cure that involves securing either investment, partnership, operatorship that can get in and develop the resource and drill new wells. So that administrative process is still ongoing at the department. I don't want to speak too much more, but you know, the goal of the department all throughout that has been, we want to see success. We want to see partnership, because we need that new investment, because we need the production. And so that continues to be our goal, and our encouragement to all the parties involved is to proceed as rapidly as we can to production.
Representative Klum.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So I was just comparing what you guys forecasted in 22 to what's happening now. And just had a couple questions. One is, in 22, I mean, SINGSA was there. We were storing gas then. Why wasn't storage included in your original graph?
Yeah, Representative Colum through the chair. Perhaps a little, speculative through the sands of time for me, and, you know, it gets a little hazy. But at the time, what we were focused on is trying to get as much, you know, it was a, the department has historically tracked this issue. We had reports every couple of years on either Cook Inlet resource, reserves, production. But, you know, we were updating that based on what we saw, the production volume from the current well stock, and really trying to assess what's a reasonable assumption about development drilling. You know, will we have 8? Will we have 12? Will we have 15? Mm-hmm. And so this was our core presentation of those kind of two elements of the equation. As we continue to dig in, obviously there's a tremendous number of other elements to that. One of the key ones is storage. Mm-hmm. And that's why in our updates we've added that, because it becomes so material on the inter-year basis. But it, you know, I don't want to call our work rudimentary, because a lot of work to it, but it, you know, this was our modern update at the time as we worked to understand that announcement by Hillcorp and the state of the market.
Follow-up? So, I mean, the predictions and what actually happened are pretty – there's big difference. And so would you say that's because Hillcorp's new 15 drills? Is that because of Hex Fury development? What is it, a combination of things? Because it looks like we were falling off the cliff in 26, and here we're falling off the cliff around 2031. So yeah. I'm just wondering – what did you not know a couple of years ago that you know that actually happened?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Representative Colum, it's a very important question and series of kind of analysis for the department to undertake, and we do undertake it. John Crowther for the record. This slide, the 2022 forecast, I don't want to shirk or limit. What the department was trying to do at the time was provide that information about well performance and expected wells to be drilled. Mm-hmm. That's a key part of the overall balance and activity in the market. We weren't necessarily trying to forecast there will be no gas on the market or there will be a material difference in 27. We were trying to provide factual information about current well stock, expected development drilling, we start to see a material issue in the near future. And when we go to our current, our most recent kind of supply and demand balance, we've included, obviously, that important storage component. We've seen, as Representative Fields alluded to, some price modification, price adjustment in the market, mm-hmm. which we didn't attempt to forecast whether there be price changes or not, would that drive more production or not. And so this is a little bit more of a holistic, our 2025 information that reflects the changes in the market on the price term, reflects storage. But we still don't assert that this is a forecast of what will happen. It's an increasing amount of information about what is happening and factual information about performance going forward or storage capacity going forward, et cetera. So it's intended to be an important part of the discussion, but not the end-all, be-all forecast.
The reason why I focused on that, because I remember seeing this a couple of years ago and we were like panicking.
Mm-hmm.
We're putting forward cuts in royalty rates. We're trying to, incentivize drilling and then to see kind of what happened. I'm just saying that, I look at DNR graphs and I take them seriously. I think you guys do serious work, but I think it was, when I look at it now, action needed to be happening, but I think, at least for me, it was a little bit more panicky than what we're seeing happening now, and I'm glad there's more drilling, and I'm glad there's storage capacity that's expanding, but that really affects the decisions we make, what you guys say. So that's why I just noticed it and pointed it out.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Colum. Through the chair, John Crowther, for the record, we take that obligation very seriously, and I appreciate that we need to continuously be available to share update and take our work very seriously when we present it. I think I would just note, this chart shows there's royalty modification by the state, so a major exercise of our authority to reduce the state take to enable some of this development. Mm-hmm. There's some state lending in there. There is price increase, which has an unfortunate negative effect for the consumer. To go from the 2022 chart to this chart has been a tremendous amount of work by everyone involved, and is unfortunately has some negative effects to, the consumer as far as cost. And so, it's possible that the reality of how this issue plays out will continue to evolve, and the department will do our best to provide as much information as we can about it.
Thank you.
I've got Representative Fields and Representative Mears.
Through the chair, a lot of positive changes in the last couple of years, and my read on it is basically the royalty modification and kitchen lights worked, and the department did some good work, mm-hmm. compelling exploration and ultimately production out of the Cosmopolitan unit. And I don't know if you all want to talk a little bit about the work you did to get meaningful production out of Cosmopolitan.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Through the chair, I think that work's very much still ongoing, so I don't want to speak too much detail to it. But as I said earlier, we view that the operator has an obligation to develop those leases. Mm-hmm. We've been doing everything we can to encourage and push them to bring in investment to enable that development, and we very sincerely hope that that will be successful in their term. They'll benefit from that. The market will benefit from that, and that'll be the best outcome. The department is certainly reviewing that issue very closely because the unit currently is in default, and without successful investment in a cure, then we and the operator will have a significant issue.
Follow up?
I just want to thank the department. They've used their existing statutory authority very well, I think, going back to both the former commissioner, this commissioner, their staff, and we had hearings and they did the work, so thank you.
Awesome. Representative Mears?
Thank you, through the chair. So I'm not going to go into my concerns too much with the flat demand curve, but this is just very top line for us. We've seen in electricity generation, there's been a lot of plant improvements for reducing the amount of natural gas needed for electrical generation. There have been, you know, some general movements with consumers for, you know, changing out light bulbs and, you know, doing that setback thermostats and those sorts of things to make some differences. But I think that as legislators and with our communication channels to our residents, that we do have the opportunity to bend that curve down a bit. Like I'd mentioned before, our natural gas storage capacity is increasing greatly so that we've got the ability to store that energy seasonally. Always a big thing in energy. How do you store it for later? So that increased capacity is huge. We've got, you know, we created the Green Bank a couple of years ago, which is now the Sustainable Energy Corporation over at AHFC. So we've got the ability to continue in that direction to reduce what our demand here is. Renewable energy is a piece of that as well, so that we can make our local gas go further. So I guess this is a call to my fellow legislators that we do have some responsibility and, well, not responsibility, ability. We can make some changes here with our communications and the other policies that we enact here so that that purple can be bigger and we can have less white space soon.
Representative Fields.
Yeah, just following up on that through the chair, maybe the department could model out what expansion of capacity at Bradley looks like in conjunction with if our utilities, CEA and MEA, are both exploring potential hydroelectric generation that would meaningfully reduce gas demand for electric generation and just maybe provide us with some multiple scenarios for a sort of gas-only approach versus a mixed approach that diversifies at least electric generation a little bit. Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, we're almost
through the chair. This, for the record, Derek Nottingham. This is an overview of just the activity that occurred in the Cook Inlet in 2025. There were 22 development wells drilled in 2025. The fields that they were drilled in, you can kind of see there. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of focus by Hillcorp in the Beluga River and North Cook Inlet fields. And also, we mentioned the Kitchen Lights development wells are being drilled now. That's activity that we haven't seen. In addition, you know, we haven't seen any additional activity to Hillcorp's drilling for quite a while, and so seeing another company get out and develop its leases is a very positive thing. And as we've mentioned already, hoping to see more of that with the Cosmopolitan unit. And also, CINGSA did expand their capacity by drilling a couple of wells in 2024 and eventually bringing them online in the 2025 timeframe. And I'll, for the sake of time, I'll just kind of move ahead to the next slide here. And I believe this is the last slide. And so it's just a summary of a lot of the activity that we've already been talking about. Hillcorp, they're always, you know, drilling in the Cook Inlet, but also they've acquired the North Fork unit from Gardas Holdings. So that's another avenue for them to kind of get out and redevelop a somewhat mature field and hopefully find some more gas there. They've also applied for approval of the Kenai Pool 6 for third-party gas storage. That was back in August of 2025, so they've applied to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And mentioned Hex Fury drilling the three wells. One of those was in the end of 2024, two of them sort of the summer, fall of 2025. They've done one workover, and a lot of that, we say, has been enabled by some of our authority by analyzing and granting a royalty modification, plus some loan authority through ADA. And as we've mentioned, Bluecrest, they're working with potential investors unit is in the default, and you know, just working with them to ensure that we could see them developing their gas in the very near future. And that fuel gas, that 10 BCF that we see is kind of the bottom piece of those graphs, that demand, that is also becoming a scarce commodity and straining all users, because the people that produce the gas want to use that to fulfill utility contracts, and other operations have been dependent upon that gas for their oil operations and other industrial activity. So I would just summarize by saying, you know, the graph does show that we are, it does look like we're going to see supply above that 70 BCF for the next 5 or so years. It is a risk forecast. There is risk that goes into it. Some things are anticipated to happen that could not happen that would significantly change that. Some things could go way better than we're anticipating and make that graph, you know, get production up to, say, 90 BCF per year or something like that, and you'd see extended runway with more purple bars out there. So there are pluses and minuses to that. We're showing kind of the mid case or mean case there, but as with anything with subsurface development, oil field development, there are risks that we're considering in that. And I believe that's the last slide.
Thank you. I've seen Representative Fields has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. If you could just talk a little bit about having only one jackup rig can be a constraint on exploration and future production. One rig in the inlet. Thank you.
Representative Fields, through the chair. John Crowther, for the record. You know, that is correct. When we first were doing our 2022 assessment and the level of activity from Hilcorp, we saw that rig, which Hilcorp had purchased and was an asset of their company, was being subscribed, but not necessarily, you know, they didn't necessarily have a program that would enable a multi-rig program in their company. When we started to see that success and interest in kitchen lights being developed, there started to be constraints on rig time, especially when you're transferring it between operators. And so we've been working with the operators, one, to ensure that the one rig that's there is utilized as much as possible. But second, we've been encouraging the operators to look at and explore the ability to bring a second rig in and run a full program with both operators. And so I think that's certainly something that we'll continue to work with them closely on, and it might be a benefit to the supply picture.
If I could ask a follow-up. So my understanding of the way that royalty reduction works, that I think you all very wisely applied with your statutory authority, is that there's a gross revenue cutoff for royalty relief. So perversely, your authority under state statute doesn't really let you eliminate the disincentive for a producer to go, say, buy a jackup rig, i.e. if a producer went up and bought a jackup rig, they don't have any incentive whatsoever to do that because they're going to get cut off from royalty reduction at the same gross revenue target. Is that understanding correct? Thank you.
Representative Fields, through the chair, if I understand your question correctly, that it is correct that the royalty modification does not take into account changes in expected expenditure costs. We assess those when we set the gross revenue target, but if an operator, say, chose to be more aggressive, that wouldn't modify our now final decision.
In closing, Madam Chair, I just identify this for the committee, because if an operator went out and, say, acquired a jackup rig for, say, $50 million, they would actually be taking a financial hit within the existing structure of royalty modification as it exists in the statute, because it's a gross figure. And I just think that's an issue that maybe we want to take up. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Representative Mears?
Thank you, through the chair. Representative Fields was getting into one of my two questions about jackup rigs, so now I only have one. So I hadn't been aware of or contemplated the pressure from utilities for getting gas under contract and how that would affect other users. I'd love to know more about those effects. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Mears, through the chair. John Crowther, for the record, just very briefly, but of course can follow up with you for more discussion. You know, those users are a couple different things. Oil production is one of them, and so we are seeing a strain on oil operators that don't necessarily have associated gas or enough associated gas that have had to buy it on the market are being priced or constrained out. And that's an issue for the department from a royalty perspective, from a market, for a supply perspective. And so that's an issue. Also, the refinery, the Kenai refinery, runs on Cook Inlet gas. And so when there's not gas available under contract for that refinery, they have to divert some of their product stream to enable their operations. Negatively affects the cost and the output for Alaskans. So the supply constraints are real in the inlet, even though we do see response to in the market, and that's a challenge, and will continue to be so unless there's a very material change. So.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up through the chair. Yeah, I'd love to get a little more in the weeds offline.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Are there any other questions from the committee? Representative Sather?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we're kind of going a little bit far afield for the report coverage, there's been a number of disruptions in federal employment. Just curious to hear if DNR has been able to pick up any experts from the federal workforce to fill some spaces or reinforce our personnel at the division.
Representative Sather, through the chair, very briefly, we have been very blessed to keep a very good team at the Division of Oil and Gas over the last several years, so we haven't needed to bring in a large number of folks. We do have a few key openings right now. If anybody's looking for a job, check out our website. with industry tightening a little bit and with the federal, we've been looking closely at those folks, and we would be eager to have skilled folks look at state employment at the department.
Representative Elam.
Thank you. Just kind of going back to the Cook Inlet oil conversation a little bit. How do you guys see the supply chain being for keeping oil coming from Cook Inlet? Because specifically to the refinery, it's a concern that I have. I would hate to see the refinery ever get into a spot where it didn't have supply chain. Because I do know that Arctic North Slope oil is not the same as Cook Inlet oil, and so it's kind of needed for production.
Representative Elam, through the chair, John Crowther for the record, it's a very important and significant challenge for just the reasons you mentioned. The refineries are very complex machines. They're built for spec for a certain inflow stream. I'll be quick in the committee's time. The refinery has adapted to bring a lot of oil over from Valdez, so it's still Alaskan oil. Some of that's been Alaskan royalty oil, which we're seeking to finalize one of those contracts soon. Some of it has been imported from outside of Alaska. And when we don't have Cook Inlet oil, we have crude slate quality issues, and we have the likelihood that more oil will be imported, and that's really a shame. So when we talk about the future of Cook Inlet, especially if we have less pressure in our gas market, some of that gas could go towards supporting those existing operations that have very delicate economics right now. And so we have seen a continued decline, and unless we have some material changes, we expect that decline may unfortunately continue. So we'll be looking at everything we can do to be helping the refinery, though, because it is absolutely critical to Alaska fuel availability.
Thank you.
All right. Now, for real, seeing no further questions from the committee, that completes our agenda for House Resources Committee meeting today. Thank you, Commissioner Designee Crowther and Director Nottingham for joining us today. Our next House Resources meeting is Wednesday, January 28th at 1 p.m., where we will hear presentations from Hillcorp, Santos, and ConocoPhillips. The time now is 2:40 p.m., and this hearing of the House Resources Committee is now adjourned.